We knew things were wrong. We didn't necessarily know how it was supposed to be, because we never were with a label that like we could just call and be like, "Hey, we're thinking about this," and they go, "Yeah, cool. Yeah, this is the budget. Go do it, or whatever, or we'll help you do it." This was like everything's a fight. Like, it was insane.
Welcome back to Labeled. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today's convo is with Shane Told of Silverstein. Now, I've got Silverstein in the club of bands that are real workhorses. Hawthorne Heights and May Day Parade, August Burns Red come to mind. Has been continuously active year after year and continuing to rack up new achievements and just do new stuff, reinvent, whatever they got to do. They just keep going. They do everything, and Silverstein's one of those bands. They seem to benefit greatly from being able to self-manage, adapt, engage in long-range planning, try new things, and they've just amassed a ton of accomplishments. Like, they've played over 2,500 shows, they have over 1 million monthly listeners on Spotify, and they just keep on going. Shane also has a great podcast called Lead Singer Syndrome, and he's always great to talk to. So in this convo, we cover the Canadian local scene, where they come from, getting on and off Victory Records and how that relationship was, and many other reflections from the last 20 years of activity and knowing Shane. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. And also, don't forget to join the Labeled Facebook group. It's a very nice group of folks compared to what I, you know, understand about the rest of the internet. So search for Labeled Facebook group, join it. All right, let's do it. Tell me about Vegas versus Canada. That's fascinating. I don't even know the story, but it's good. Yeah. That's a pretty different kind of deal.
A lot more guns here, I think. Sure. That's probably the first one. No, like sometimes, you know, you're on the road and I'm like, someone cuts me off or whatever. And I'm like thinking about, you know, yelling at them, you know, whatever, gesturing. And I'm like, wait, no, can't do that here. They got guns.
Yeah, in Canada, you could just, I know that light Canada, pulls up,
right? No,
yeah,
I don't know. No, I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, it is a lot different for sure. Some of the little things I didn't realize were different. Like, you guys have so many more bills you got to pay. Like in Canada, we've got our hydro bill, which is basically electric and water in one, and then there's the gas bill, and that's it. Here, there's like a garbage bill I've got to pay for them to pick up my garbage. That's a thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's just like HOA. That's all a whole new thing for me too.
Those are terrible.
Yeah, that's a whole thing. And what else? There's even there's a water bill, but then there's also a I don't know. They take the water away bill. Like, it's such,
yeah, right, right.
Water.
Yep.
It's like a I don't know. It's fucking bizarre.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, but it's that all that stuff confused me. I'm like, wait, how much different shit do I have to sign up for? You know, but mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I like it here a lot. And like, I'm looking at a mountain right now out my window, which is cool. Cause that's not a thing where I grew up or where you grew up really. Right. So, you know, it's, I don't know. It's cool. I just like the vibe here. There's so much to do. A lot of people have moved out here too. I have a lot of friends out here already. Oh. Great golf. And, you know, what
great
else is
golf? It? What, how long and what caused the move?
I've been here for more than 6 months now. I don't know. I just kind of wanted to change. I went through some like weird life stuff a couple years back, going, you know, breakup and all that stuff. And I was like, you know what? I got to get out of this town, and I'm like, I don't really want to move back to Toronto because I was there for so long. I felt like a bit of a step back. And I guess the biggest thing is my sister lives in Las Vegas. She's been here for over 20 years now, almost 20 years. So, you know, I got family here too and everything. And I kind of already know the city because I've visited her so much, spend every Christmas here, you know, that kind of a thing. So, I don't know. It felt good. It's easy. There's a big airport. I'm only like
definitely,
10 minutes away from
definitely
the airport.
Definitely good for flights.
It's really easy to if I got to go somewhere, which, you know, as you know, we do all the time.
You got a lot of going somewheres to do.
Yep. Exactly.
What about the rest of the guys? Are they all still in Ontario or they've moved around?
Yeah, everyone's in Ontario. Josh moved way up north, actually. Like that's so him though, you know? He's got this out in the boonies, this big property with like he's got a freaking river in his backyard and stuff. He loves that stuff. So he's out in the out there, and then two of the guys are right in downtown Toronto, and then Paul's out in the suburbs where we grew up. So it works. It's not a big deal, you know. These days you can do so much through
Oh
the
yeah.
computer, like you
Yep.
know, all that stuff. So it's you don't have to be people who are like, how do you guys practice? It's like, well, we
Good
get
point.
together and practice when we actually practice, which isn't all the time,
It's
you know?
not right. That's definitely a question people ask all the time. It's like, well, we're gonna play a bunch of songs, most of which are very we played a million times.
Yeah.
So we're playing a different order, some different transitions. You know, but we know how to play most of the ones that we are playing. You know, sometimes you do an album playthrough or some other thing, and you have to
Right.
learn or whatever. You need a practice day or two, but
But I'm sure it's like for you guys, you get in a room and you're going over some new stuff maybe some you've never even played before because it was worked out in the studio and who played what and who knows is playing it as a full band. But then you get to the point where it's like, do we really need to play Walls? Like, do we really need to rehearse Walls and waste the 3 minutes playing like a song we've played literally thousands of times?
No. And if we even if we're doing
Yeah.
a playthrough, or we did a playthrough the other day in the green room, because we were doing some stuff different, and Devin wasn't there, so Chris, the guitar player, was singing a bunch of parts. So we had to go through a bunch of songs, and
Oh yeah.
it was fun, but I was like, is you know, when we start running a song and you go, do we like after the first intro, you get into the first verse, like we got this, right? It's like, don't make me go through another 2.5 minutes of strumming the party song or whatever. It's like I there's no way I can forget it. But you know, it's like so you just jump ahead and you're frustrated with the other guys, like, you know this, right? And it's like but it doesn't come back to you sometimes in the abstract until it's like, you know what I mean? Like it comes in my head, it's like I don't know all the songs if I had to think about them, but if I go to play them with a little bit of pressure, it's going to be there. So it's
I
like a
know.
weird, it's not totally all mentally there, but it comes back in this
Yeah, it's
weird way.
there's a definitely a muscle memory, there's no question. And it's the
Yeah.
same with vocals too. If I start thinking about the lyrics or what they mean or anything in the middle of the performance, I'm fucked
You're
because that
gone.
it
Yeah, you're
doesn't work.
screwed.
Yeah, it
It
doesn't
doesn't
work.
work.
You have to like just do it. But
Yeah.
I'll tell you, man, so many times we'll start a song and like there'll be like a you know instrumental intro and it's you know the verse is coming and I'm like thinking in my head, what are the words?
So I
What
do
are
not
the
know it.
first?
I do not know
What
it.
are
I
the
do not
first?
know
I
it.
do not, and this like you
And
have
then
this crazy anxiety right until the point and it just comes out. Perfect, perfect, and key everything.
Usually, right.
Okay. All right. Well,
Yeah.
I do know it. And that was
The
anxiety over
guitar
nothing.
version that is so funny to me is I'll be in some crazy situation, some stage, in some city, and all of a sudden I think, where am I? Who am I? What am I doing right now? And I look down at my fingers and they're just going. I'm going, what the hell is going on down there? It's like, what key is this song in? What notes are those? I do not know. I do not know, but it's happening and I'm observing it. It
Oh,
feels good when that happens, but it's a little freaky. Or yeah, I can feel anxiety for a second and it's just like, well, you had to trust something else outside of you somehow that's gonna.
yeah.
It's going to be there, and it is. And then you're listening. I don't know. It's
Boom.
just, it's totally different than 20 years ago. So that's what's cool about this, you know, talking to a 20-year. I think that's what's most exciting to me is to be talking here to another 20-year veteran,
Yeah.
so similar that has had continuous activity, like not a hiatus and a thing, whatever. That is so
Yeah.
rare. And the amount of
I see.
reps and the amount of the just what's involved with that is a very rarefied air, really. And so that's
Yeah.
like there's so many different, you know, ways I want to go with it.
True.
But that's what I think is really cool to have the opportunity because we're hitting that 20-year thing now where there's a bunch of like the 20-year thing is now we're just now getting there for the whole scene. There's been a few things that have been 20 years, but most of the things that where people are going to celebrate 20 years of XYZ is coming up this year, next year, 2 or 3 years. It's like I think that's going to be it's just a real interesting opportunity to reflect, basically. So
No, absolutely. I've known you for almost 20 years, I think. I think next year will be, we're like, 6 months from now, I think will be 20 years since you and I met. It is crazy. And you know, what's funny is like, I think you grow up and you think like, oh, in 20 years, I'm going to be this old, you know, 40 something year old guy. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you think you're going to be a little bit smarter or you think you're going to be less cool. Or it's like, I feel exactly the same.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Like I still like the same shit. I don't know, man. Like, I guess I'm like, things slow down a little bit. Maybe I go to bed a little bit earlier, but that's about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I do a lot on this podcast and try to trace is these personality types. And something that's weird that popped in my head when you say that is like, when I was a little kid, I was probably odd. And one of the things that people would thought, you know, I would interface with adults and the world in a way where I wasn't acting, you know, I was already acting the way that I act right now when I was pretty young, like as far as my attitude and the way I talk to adults or authority, like I was already, and now that I've gotten older, I'm still acting the same way too. And a way that is like, I've always kind of been the same since I was a little kid to now, whereas other people, they act like a kid, then they act like a this, and then they act like, and I've changed over my life, but I have that eerie sense, and there's a lot of youthful people that stay in music where it's like, they're childlike still, but even when they were children, they were not normal as children either. So it's like this consistency across the things I like and do and the way I behave. And you have the same thing.
Yeah, no, I guess I do. I never really thought about it, but yeah, like, you know, in those terms, but I guess so. I always said like, it was weird. I was very, I don't want to say intelligent because that sounds like a pretentious thing to say, but I was able to understand things quickly, like in school.
When you were little.
Yeah, when I was little. Yeah. So let's talk about math tests. Like I never had to study for tests or anything like kind of going up until maybe it was like the ninth grade or the 10th grade when people were like, oh, I stayed up like late studying. I was like, oh, I never really done that before, but I guess maybe I should. And then what just happened was my work ethic didn't really get better.
That goes along with it. It's like, I can pass the test, but why would I have to even try? Yeah. Right.
But every year, my ninth grade, it was like, okay, I got all like 80s and 90s. And then like every year of high school, it went down like 10%, you know, it was like, I got, I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, more things came into my life and I was like going to shows on weeknights and I like, you know, I was going out with my friends and whatever, things like that. Right. Started to happen more as my adolescence, but I always felt like I was, you know, people talk about a late bloomer. I was like the opposite, which isn't better, not better. So it is kind of funny that you say that, because I think that that's definitely been a part of me too.
So I am still more curious about that. I actually do identify as a late bloomer, but in different, it's like different ways. In some things I feel like I'm a late bloomer, but at some things were present with me extremely early. But the thing that's the same, the fascinating thing is the mindset where you're doing school, but you don't care about school, but you can do good in school. But you're not tuned into the achievement of that is what, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're making worse grades in high school because you're interested in other things.
Yeah. It's weird, right? Because you always think, if I could go back, right? Oh man, if I could go back, it'd be like, oh, high school's just, that's just like your job. Just go do that. Right. Just like, put in the time, do the work, get amazing grades, get a scholarship, you know, go have an amazing life. It's like, it's that easy to really like think about, but it's not that easy when you're 16, you know? And I don't know. It's interesting. I've thought about that a lot going back, being like, huh. But of course, you know, I got no regrets really. Like if I didn't spend hours in my bedroom, you know, playing guitar, writing songs, thinking about music, listening to music, you know, if all I did was study chemistry or something, don't think I'd be here right now. So it's like education, what was more important for me based on my life. And you know, talk about the last 20 years of being a professional musician. It's like, it is true that like, as much as like, it's easy to just be like, okay, let's just focus on one thing in your life, you know, and do the normal get the college degree and work your way up a company ladder. That probably could have worked, but obviously we're on a podcast talking about me now because I've done something else that's people think is important, right? So
yeah, an alternative path that you self-determined, right, and whatever. But you know, the difference to me there is I'm not even a big fan of the word education. I don't even get it. It's like I value learning, you know. Right. Yeah. And then there's this other thing where there's credentialing, where like if you wanted to take that other path, you're like, oh, it's not just study chemistry. It's like get straight A's, get the highest possible SAT score, and you're still not getting into some elite college unless you do every extracurricular and have this resume and look like the perfect, you had to like do all this image, man, you know, all your stuff goes into all this stuff. And that's not the same as learning things. Like learning things is just, totally you not. Pay attention to them. Not for everybody, but for people like you, you just pay attention to what's interesting and the learning occurs. And then the attitude seems to be, so correct me if I get out of line here, it's just a pattern. And what I understand about your personality is you just look at something and go, I think I can do that. And then you start doing it. And then like you're not, there's no fear in jumping into a new world and just doing the thing. You assume that you can do it, but you know you don't know how to do it now, and then life is the process between those two things.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons I've learned is over time, whenever you see someone doing something, you're like, I could do that. The first thing to think is maybe, but not that well, and give that person some credit for what they're doing. Like, don't think you're just good. Like, I can just go back there and do it as well as them right away, because that's just not the case. Mm-mm. And I think there's a really good lesson there to learn, you know, to keep yourself a little bit in check with all those things. But what usually ends up happening with me is I see somebody doing something. I don't think like I can do that. It's like, I can figure out a different way to do that.
Mm.
Like the punk rock way to do that. Like, how can I like cut a corner here or figure out a way here to do it, you know? With basically everything, you know,
You
know, even we were just talking about this the other day. It's like how much does this band pay to do this thing? Like, wait, what, your backdrop cost how much? Okay, I'm going to find a way to do, I'm just using a backdrop as an example. Perfect. I'm going to get a backdrop for like a quarter of the cost or a tenth of the cost. I'm going to figure out how to do that. And that's always been something that I've always been excited about, you know,
right.
every facet of my life, you know, it's, oh, well, how can I, and it's not really like fucking anyone over to get ahead. It's like being creative in the way of, okay, like, well, why do you have to do things the normal, you know, expensive way when it can be like, oh, I could just, you know, like I'm looking at my desk right now. I literally found a piece of wood down the street in a construction site. And I was like, that looks like a good piece of wood. Brought it in my garage, sanded it up a couple times, and here it is. It's on my desk. It's holding up my speakers. It's the perfect size. You know what I mean? Free.
Yeah, and it has more meaning and attachment than it would if you bought it at freaking stupid place.
It looks great, too. Like, you can't see it, but whatever. It looks great. So this is just and that was just the other day. So I think this is part of me to just always keep my eyes open for you know, things I can do to, you know, just to like, I think I enjoy it, and I think it's good for learning, you know, another way of learning things, you know?
So it's the way you initially framed it was almost like, you know, people develop this sometimes negative self-talk, like it's lazy or cut a corner or cheat. And you're like, I'm not, first of all, you have a value and a principle that you also articulate, which is, it's not to fuck somebody else over to get ahead. Cause of course not. Like,
no, and not, I didn't steal. That I didn't steal this. And I didn't steal this beautiful piece of wood. It was in the dumpster. So,
Totally. And then to cut a corner, it's like, oh, okay, but why don't you just do it the right way? And you go, but right way? And you know, it's like, and then, so it's like some people have this real extreme reaction to stuff. You go, it costs how much for a banner? It's like you're reacting to something that sounds like bullshit. And then you're on the alert. It's like, okay, where's the hack? What can I, and that's, and then creativity. That's, and which is what else you said in that statement. So, you're all over it. That's just like that. And a lot of people that think that way get labeled, targeted, said, called lazy, every other thing, you know, saying maybe, you know, so I don't really know, like if you didn't have the results, you could, or the, maybe if you didn't have the real drive or ability, maybe you wind up in prison or something. I don't know. Who knows? But your value, it's not to screw somebody over and it's not to be lazy. It's just, it's kind of where the creativity comes from, is assessing every situation in a unique way and saying what is possible here.
Totally. And I think that just that's thinking outside of the box is maybe when you look at, you know, all the people that started bands, whatever, at whatever time, why me? You know, like, mm-hmm. And I'm sure you thought about this too. It's like, you're not the best guitar player.
Not anywhere close.
No, I'm not the best singer in the world. I can carry a tune, I guess. I gotten better, worked on it. But, but there's no reason why you pick me out of the crowd, right? Or is there, right? So, what is it? And I think that part of that just comes to your overall, mindset about things.
One of the reasons I'm curious about your values is because it's got to be really true, even though I can't trace everything. I have this feeling when I think back about it on when I met you, when I encountered your band, where that was in our career at the very beginning, where, and then you coming out of Canada, like you guys had something going when you took us on tour, you were headlining.
Mm-hmm.
You chose us, and you were some amount of, really at the time, months ahead, but it seemed like incredible amount ahead because you seemed to understand everything. It was probably our third tour, and you had this and that and the money and the things. It's like you had everything worked out, and you have Paul, and it's like, oh my gosh, like these guys know how the whole thing works, and you came out of this scene in Canada and already had a bunch of stuff. So really, I'm thinking that however you were formed, where you got your values, how that was influenced, by the time it gets to us early on, was a big influence on us. And even some of the DNA that comes out of wherever you come from, I have it now. Like, it came from you. Mm-hmm. And how, that's what pops in my mind is, like, there's you. And then you got Paul Kohler, who's just a maniac, an absolute maniac. and the two, then to have the two of you together in one band, what you're able to have done that's DIY and keeping it trim and tight and flexible and whatever that is, that's really unique. And then here you are 20 years later, and here we are 20 years later. And of course, we have all the similarities, but there's a definite link. So I'm kind of curious, tracing out of that Canadian scene, how you learned what you learned so fast to get to the point where it would have been our third tour in 2004. And
yep.
That tour was when they came on, opener was Hawthorne Heights, then us, then Alexis on Fire, Silverstein headline.
Yep.
One of the coolest, best tours. Is I've learned more from that experience and had better relationships than almost anything since.
It was a great tour, and it was our first ever headliner, actually. Mm-hmm. So we had done random headline dates, here and there. Oh, we're going to go play the freaking this VFW hall and I guess headline, but this was the first time, people were buying a ticket to see our band, and I don't even remember how you guys got on it. I think we just liked you.
We had just had a record out a couple months, so
I think we just liked the record and we heard it somehow, and you guys were on tooth and nail. It was like you guys were on a label that was doing stuff. Was like, okay, we were able to get money from Tooth and Nail to market the tour, and we were able to get money from Equal Vision that was Alexa on Fire was on. And then the other band you didn't mention was The Hire.
Oh, The Hire, right. They did
play for Hawthorne. And they, which is so funny because they had this little EP at the time, and the first song on it, I still warm up every single show to that first song on that first Hire EP.
Oh, wow.
That played on that tour. So it just, I don't know, it used to get in my head and I used to sing it before we would go on, after they would go on, and it just became a thing. And I still sing that song every single time. So it's,
what
it's,
song
it's
is weird. It?
I don't know what it's called, but it's like the chorus is like, I'm sorry you left home, you gotta make it on your own.
And no, that singer was named Seth.
That's right, Seth, yeah. And he's in Vegas, actually. I should hit him up. Because they're from Vegas. But we're getting way off track. But, you know, I think it's funny to think back to that, how you thought we had it all figured out.
Oh, yeah. I learned a lot instantly by just looking and asking questions. It's like, oh, I just asked Paul, and he goes, and he just starts talking and explaining this. Or I asked Billy, how does your money work? Because we hadn't made any money yet. And Billy says, this is when I go, wait, what? This is like one of the most profound things I ever heard. It's like, we're making $200 a night, $150. We're selling merch, and we're splitting up some cash, and we have no money in the bank. We just get some cash from merch, and we split it up or whatever. And we just had got started. And I asked Billy, I said, how do y'all do about money? He goes, well, we have a salary, but we keep it low or something like that. And he said that y'all had $50,000 in the bank. And he said, because you were scared or whatever. You hadn't started splitting up, you know, you started to accumulate money somehow, but you hadn't figured out how to like distribute it exactly yet. And I was like, what? Like, it just, I've never heard a number that big. And I was like, what would you ever do if you had 50,000? I was like, how are they? And it's just, you know, self-managed from there. And I just was like, whoa, this is like real stuff. I just thought I didn't realize it could be like that. It's just like such a big deal.
What a weird flex, though.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was asking a bunch of questions. It's like, but how does it work? And what happens when you, because you were just ahead, and it was like, well, we have money in the bank, but we're not really sure exactly. But it was pretty disciplined. And I was like, wow. I was just like, respect, you know?
Yeah, we definitely weren't the band that got to the gas station and like everybody grabbed money out of the box to go buy a drink or buy cigarettes or snacks. Like we were like, we didn't pay ourselves at all really until it was like, okay, we've got enough money to split like at the end of the tour. And I remember this one, the first time we ever made money was that year before that tour. We were opening for Strike Anywhere. And I remember we had paid all of our merch debts off and everything. And we had, you know, we had like a van payment, but we already like did the down payment on the van and all this stuff. And I remember we had $7,000 that was just our money. And we'd been touring for like a year at that point. It was like, wow, $7,000 to split five ways for a year. Like, it was still like, wow, it's $7,000. And then I left it in a hotel room.
And lost it?
No, we got it back. But it was so funny. We used to carry our money in this silver briefcase that looked like you would carry money in it, like at the movie.
yeah.
You know, the briefcase.
Carry it in the hotel room every night, right?
Yeah, we would bring it in the hotel room every night. And back then, you know, we would just usually play a show and then we would just start driving. And then we would see like a Motel 6 on the side of the road. And we would just, you know, sneak six or seven or how many people we had in the hotel room. And we just, you know, lucky people would sleep on the bed and whatever, right? So we did that one time. It was a Motel 6 and it was near Dallas. And so we, you know, we did our thing, woke up in the morning, drove for a little bit, went to the gas station to get gas. And then I was like, oh my God, I don't have it.
That's got to be one of the worst feelings you've ever had.
Yes. All this pressure. $7,000. Actually, well, it was $7,000 in profit. I think we had more money carrying. Because the other thing is we're Canadian, so we didn't have a bank account in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what to do with money. That was like a thing. We'd have like our merch. Like we'd be like, can we please pay you, like merch company? Can we please pay you or front you money? Because we don't want to carry it around in a van. So, you know, I get this. I'm like, oh my God, I don't have it. I left it in the hotel room. And everyone's like, are you fucking serious? I'm like, yes. So the worst part, not only were we a couple hours away from Dallas at that point, we didn't even remember which Motel 6 it was. Because we
crazy.
So we had this book. It was a Motel 6 catalog that had literally all of them listed in the entire United States. And we went to Dallas and we just started calling them, all the ones in the Dallas area. And I was like, hi. And I think it was like the third one I called and they were like, yep, we got it. We got your case. And I was like, all right, we're coming back for it. And we got it back. And I was like, man, that was a couple rough hours from when I realized until we got it back. And then of course we're late for the show and everyone's mad at me. And you know, but hey,
it all crumbles there. So I knew it. I knew I was a screw up. I knew I was lazy. I'm the dumbest. We're never going to be all that.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh man. I'm so glad you got it back just for more, you know, it's not the, you would have overcome it, but those are tough things.
Yeah, man. But you know, we didn't learn, but just to finish up that question, cause it is an interesting question. We always felt like we didn't know anything. We were just kind of making it up as we went along, and we were learning things from you guys. I remember you guys had this merch system where you used to keep your t-shirts in those organizing bins with the plastic ones with the drawers.
Yeah,
you had this system, and you would load them in, and you'd have like your shirts rolled up in sizes. And we were like, "Oh, wow, that's really really cool." So you know, we started like rolling our shirts and taping them up and everything for a while too. You know, it was like lots of stuff we learned along the way from different bands too. But we never felt like we knew anything. And we certainly weren't a band from like New York or LA where, you know, there's more music industry driven, where people kind of understand how that stuff works. Like we didn't know anything in terms of like the music industry and what is supposed to happen, you know,
okay.
No idea.
Okay. So, when after this period of time, because this is still, I'm going to say, relatively early before the industry and all the other, when the scene boomed, then the people that were then attracted, both industry and talent, they had a different vibe. It wasn't as grounded, and they were more about the flashy or the. I don't know how to describe that, or if you have language for that, but you were kind of coming from a purer place. And then we'll get into the scene blowing up around that time. But you were stumbling into it from a organic scene coming out of Canada. So tell me about what that was and what you got from like what the values and principles that you know, how does that come out of that Ontario scene?
There was no rock star shit like at all. There were no bands that wore outfits on stage or makeup or anything like that. It was like, you know, I would go to a show we were playing. I would mosh for the bands before we played.
And who were these bands that you were?
You know, just other local bands, you know, in the scene. But some of them were like Alexis on Fire and Monine and Boys Night Out. Maybe not as much Billy Talent, but they were around. You know, there were bands that definitely did stuff. I went on to do some big things, got signed to labels, but it was a real, real sense of community in a scene. And
those bands were going with you before any of them were signed. You knew all of them before they were signed.
Yes. All of them.
Yeah.
And it was great. I remember Boys Night Out was the first one, and we heard that they got signed to Ferret Records. And Grade was already on Victory too, but they were a bit older than us, so they were kind of like the band we all looked up to. So they were already on Victory, and they were from the same city as us. But I remember Boys Night Out got signed, and it was like, oh my god, like really? Like they're a good band, but it's like it didn't seem like anyone in our community like it was attainable, you know. And I don't think we realized how special our scene was. You know?
No, I mean, those are some of my favorite bands ever. And I promise, this has nothing to do with just I'm talking to you today. It comes up all the time. And they say, who's your favorite bands? And it's like, well, the Canadian bands are the best ones. And I mean, Monine and Boys Night Out musically are so important to me musically. And the freaking all of them, Alexis on Fire, you guys and everything too. The funnest, coolest, not shittiest. Like, how is it like that coming from where you come from? Just the best bands.
I'll take it. I'll take not
least shitty, funniest, best music.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I mean, we're all from the same area. We're all like similar upbringings, I think, for the most part. And I think what it was is like all the bands were pretty good. So we all had to work hard to kind of get to a certain level where we were like, okay, well, we're going to play music in front of people. We don't want to suck. And there were bands that like weren't very good. There were bands that sucked that didn't care and whatever. But the bands that rose to the top, I think we all sort of pushed each other a little bit to, you know, to try to write better songs and play them better and record them better and, you know, not looking back, not that anything was maybe that great, but at the time it felt special. But
2001 and two is this period.
Yeah. 2001 to yeah. I'd say even a little bit earlier probably, but yeah, man, I mean, it was a really, really cool time, but we didn't realize, you know, we'd heard about scenes like in New Jersey and Long Island, New York, and you know, those kind of places where it's like, oh, okay, well, you know these bands and they're so great, but we didn't realize like, oh, there's a show with local bands on a Friday night, a Saturday night, and there's like 300 people here to see, like, not even to see a band signed band, just a local band. It didn't even matter who was playing, and you'd have hundreds of people every time. So it was a real movement, and it was pretty cool. I forget where I was, but yeah, man.
What I'm interested in there is you said there's no rock star shit at that point. So yeah, how do we get from there to when is this freaking industry? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you fast forward to, I don't know, 2005, 2006, it's like, okay, this is different.
Yeah.
The influences and the people involved and all, you know, it's a different world in just a few years.
It's true. I mean, yeah, not to say like we didn't care. It wasn't like we didn't care about fashion. Like, I still like wore what I was, but I still wear every day what I wear on stage. You know, there's no like, I don't really have much of a, I don't know, you know, it's, I'm not really that kind of person, but that was the same way it was when I was a kid. It would be like, okay, I'm going to mosh for this band. Then we're going to go on stage and play. And then later on this other band's playing, I'm definitely going to mosh for them. It was like, it was just a community of like, I'm on stage, I'm in the crowd, we're all there, this band's cool, like, these are cool guys, this band, well, whatever, they're our friends, maybe we don't like their music as much, but they're our friends, and, like, that dude brought the PA, you know, or whatever, right? There was a real, like, sense of everybody belonged to something, and, you know, once Boys Night Out got signed, I remember they were kind of the first one. I think we all thought like, whoa, like this is maybe attainable. We got signed to Victory, which is a much bigger label than Ferret. And I remember the shit talkers like, what? But Boys N' Out is way better than Silverstein. How come Silverstein got, you know, on like a bigger label than they did? And, you know, it was just, and then Monin got signed, I think, was it Vagrant? Maybe that, or something else at that time. I can't remember, but it was just really an interesting time when all of a sudden the top five bands in the scene kind of all got signed. We're all putting out records on labels, making real albums, not just demo tapes and CDs and whatever, touring, all that stuff. And then, yeah, it definitely changed. I think we all our bands went on tours and we met other people that we learned things like, you know, whether it's from guys, bands like you guys, or we learned a lot from Honor to Ashes. That was one of the first tours we ever got. So
yeah, they were out there early doing really well. That's right.
They were. And that was part of the Long Island, New York scene. So, yeah, man, I don't know. It was, I think maybe we started to think a little bit more about things seriously because we knew there was going to be pictures taken that were maybe going to be printed in magazines, you know, and like there were going to be, like, I remember the first interview I did was freaking bizarre, you know, like, why do you want to talk to me? Why do you care what I have to say? You know, or signing an autograph the first time. Like, I don't even have an autograph. Like, I'm just going to write what I write on my bank check. Looks like shit. You know, I'm not a very artistic, neat person. Like, you know, I was like, do I really have to practice a signature right now? Like, how lame is that? But I did, you know, like, it was weird. It was really a weird time kind of realizing that this was the thing that maybe I had to take seriously. That was like a career, which still sounds funny to think about a career because obviously it is. It's been 20 years. It's longer than most sports athletes. You know, it's a real thing. But for so long, I kind of pushed that away. I was like, this is just, you know, we're gonna put out a couple records. We're gonna play a couple shows. Maybe we'll go to Europe once, and then we'll break up and we'll go. I'll go back to university. I'll get a real job.
There's nobody at all. Even the people that loved it the most and were invested who were picturing multi-decade anything or more than a few album anything that did not. And, you know, everybody's pretty sure as soon as we stop touring, we will be totally forgotten.
Yeah.
That was the complete assumption. Like we're doing it now in this moment, and when this moment ends, it will have ended. Like, and it won't even be remembered. Like it's just for now is the way it feels. Like we're gonna do this for now, and then we'll have a life. But right now, we're gonna do this. That's what it felt like.
I had exactly. I had nothing led me to believe that this was going to have any longevity, or anyone would care for any length of time, especially decades.
Yeah, it's crazy, shocker. Man. And technology is a big part of that story, you know, because if it was like this, you know what I mean? Like if it was just physical CDs and stuff, that would have, some people would have had them, and there was no internet. You know, if it wasn't for the internet and the technology and the streaming, maybe it does kind of just, everybody would have forgot, or it wouldn't be near what it is today, obviously. So technology is part of the story. But when it, but building the relationships with fans, you didn't realize how permanent that was, like to build the bond of band and core audience or fans. I don't think anybody understood. It wasn't even in the cultural zeitgeist, like in to have small niche businesses and stuff like it is today. Like people didn't realize what 1,000 or 2,000 true fans or believers was. That wasn't even in part of the culture at that time to realize the power of that.
No, 100%. That is such a good point, man. Yeah. I don't know. I just never really thought it was going to be anything. And I think the real reason it has become something that is 20 years later is a lot of it isn't technology or anything. It's people's memories of it.
Right.
And the core memories that people have built from seeing bands like ours and going, I had an amazing time at this show, and these were my people and whatever. It's like, I can go back on Spotify and I can listen to that first record. It doesn't sound very good. Maybe it sounds better to me because I have the nostalgia of like remembering it. You know what I mean? But pound for pound, like it doesn't sound nearly as good as music coming out today. But you know, but it's the memories and it's the feelings that you have. And I've been going to see this band every couple years for the last 20 years. It's like part of a part of me, you know. Right. And I think that's been the real reason that we've continued to be able to do this at a high level. So
those experiences, loud music, bumping into people, high trust, like I can mosh, like whatever, those super intense experiences that are created, that's what people love. And you're attached to it, and the song's attached to it, and the song, you know. And if you have these super intense physical experiences with people that are like you, you know what I mean, of any culture of any time, and then do that year after year, you can't, like that becomes a part of a person, you know, just like anything. So it happens to be you and your music or whatever, but that's that situation is created by a group of people being a trusted, it's like a trusted, I don't know, whatever that is, that's the thing that really creates it. And then the song that you can listen to on Spotify connects you to that across time, and it's just filled, you know, with meaning, I guess. I don't know.
I guess I still don't really know, right?
Yeah, but you weren't thinking of it. It's not like you're just doing what seemed fun or whatever at the time and everything.
Exactly.
But I think there's a connection. My hypothesis would be that there's a connection with that organic and pure on-ramp to this, that when the scene does break and become this commercial thing that is big, then the people that got in then were attracted to the glam and the flash and the money and the status more so, you know, at that time. And then most bands, of course, don't make it or make it as long or whatever, but it's the pureness of where you come from that probably has something to do with the longevity. But what do you remember about it becoming this commercial thing, and then the agents and the managers and all? How did you navigate all the business boom that came in the coming years?
That's a great question, man. And like, it's weird. I think we were never on a major label. We've never been on a major label. We've had some major label distributors, you know, and we had sort of a deal in Canada a little bit, like where we were on Universal. So we'd kind of go there and we'd have meetings, but no one ever told us what kind of songs to write. You know, we never had like that. We never had an A&R guy say, oh, you need to write this hit song for radio. And I know there were other bands that did sign to major labels that had that stuff going on. And I know if you talk to like maybe somebody like Thursday, who, you know, or Thrice, you know, those bands were signed to Island Def Jam or whatever, kind of at the peak of the scene. I'm sure they would have a lot of a different experience, but we were on Victory where it was like, we could turn in anything and they would just put it out. It didn't matter. We had full creative control, which was probably a blessing and a curse looking back. And then, yeah, they never told us what to wear. They never, you know, said you should have long hair or short hair or like, you know, whatever. And, you know, like, and I never cared about the fashion really at all. It was like, I guess I got to wear something in this photo shoot, but it was never like, oh, well, I have to look like this, this, and this, and never. And like, you know, look at me right now. Like, I, you know, I'm wearing a hat and a t-shirt. I don't have any tattoos on my arms. Like, I'm just, this is just me. I've never been attracted really to the like glam goth thing ever. You know, like I was, as much as I liked the Misfits, I didn't really care what they looked like, you know, or like the AFI thing. People really, oh, Davey Havoc, whoa, what's he wearing? I never cared about that at all. It was like, well, the song's good. What are they saying? You know, what kind of amps are they playing? Like, this is the shit that I like cared about. So, you know, so I don't know, man, but I guess like we just really separated ourselves from it. And like, sure, we have a few cringy photos looking back, but I think a lot less than some of the bands, you know, like I actually, cause I just moved out here and I kept all my AP magazines. So I've got all the alt press magazines from like 04 to like, you know, 2009 or whatever. And man, it's really funny to look through and be like, everyone had the same fucking haircut. Yeah. Everybody did, you know? And I don't know, man, but it was weird. Things got commercialized for sure, but like I really never, it didn't affect me at all, I don't think, except maybe I grew my hair a little bit longer.
Business wise, especially, Paul Kohler was tour managing, and then y'all have remained self-managed, or do you have periods where you had bigger management teams?
Well, Paul and I early on, well, I'll tell you a quick story about Paul. You know, he joined our band. We'd already like played, we hadn't played any shows yet, but we'd had a few practices and we were looking for a drummer, and Paul came in and he was very quiet, kind of awkward. I guess Josh said, like, we used to practice in Josh's basement, and Josh said he like came in and he was a bit early, and he just like set up the drums and set him up, and then him and Josh just like sat there in silence until everybody else showed up. Like, how awkward is that?
Yeah.
But he had, I remember he had a pager and a cell phone. He had both. And I was like, why do you need both? He's like, oh, well, yeah, if somebody pages me, then I can call them. I'm like, yeah, no, I get what they do, but why would you need both? If someone just call you? Anyway, but he was always like, he was a tech guy even back then. And I remember we hadn't even played a show yet, and he made us a website. I was like, you know, at this time, I was like, what do we need a website for? Like, we're not Metallica. Website. We had a SilversteinEmo.com was the first website we had.
Nice.
And yeah. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was emote.org/Silverstein. That was the first one, emote.org. But he was always ahead of the game with that stuff. He was always like, he was just very into the promotion, the marketing, the understanding of all that, you know. And me and him basically ran the band way over selling 100,000 records, I'd say. And then it got to the point we sold like 100,000 records on our first album. And it was like, maybe we need somebody, because like, I don't want to call Sennheiser and be like, hey, I need microphones. I'm also the singer of the band. Like, I need to get a manager just to like do stuff like that. You know, we talked about setting up like a fake email account, like manager@silversteinmusic.com, like to send that stuff, you know, because we didn't want to do it ourselves. So we ended up hiring a manager, David Lefkowitz. He also managed Primus. I think still does manage Primus. Nice guy. But it was always like, even with all the other managers we had, we probably had three or four throughout the time. Paul was doing everything behind the scenes, you know, even like he was doing all the day-to-day stuff. He was making all the decisions. And once in a while, like we'd have a manager. Like we had the same manager as Billy Talent that got us on a Billy Talent tour. And he also was in the same management group as Avril Lavigne. We got an Avril Lavigne tour. So there were like those kind of perks we got through having managers. But in terms of like big time, big picture career things or like how we ran the band, it was always like Paul and myself that pretty much made those decisions. And now Paul is our manager. He has his own management company, Tandem Management. There's a whole network of managers all doing it the right way. Artist, super artist friendly.
What's the wrong way?
It's awesome. What's the wrong way?
I know the right way, but what's the wrong way?
The wrong way is taking net percentages. Gross percentages from bands that are not making money and like not sustainably making money. And I won't name names, but I remember there was a band opening up for us on a pretty big tour. We were co-headlining it and they were the undercard. And it was like, you know, this band's probably clearing, you know, $1,500 to $2,000 a night in merch. Enough to money that you're making money, right? If you don't have a manager, at least you're making money. And they had to literally send their money, their manager, cash every single day for the percentages that they were making on their guarantee and on their merch every day. And if they didn't, it'd be like, where's the money? Like, oh, sorry, we couldn't get to Western Union today.
That's mafia pimp type stuff. That's
insane.
And
I told them, I was like, oh, well, we I think at that point we didn't have a manager. Well, we don't have one. What do we need one for? What does this guy do for you?
It's a pimp.
Well, you know, he you can't figure out a way to book your own buses? It's not that hard, man. You know?
Yeah, they say they do the stuff that's scary or the dumb kids or these disorganized people can't do. But if you get a freaking Paul, you can do it. Then it's like, now what do y'all do?
Yes, get a Paul, everybody. Aspiring bands, get a Paul or be a Paul is what you got to do. It's true. No, I mean
it's hard to be that, but it makes the other stuff evaporate pretty quick when you realize if you're doing it yourself and you're in tune is the word that matters to me about finance or management or whatever is in tune. If you're in tune and not disconnecting from the scary stuff or the awkward or the complicated or the ugly and the numbers, if you're in tune, you can do it, and it will always seem dumb to pay somebody else. Or, you know, but there's something you're always afraid you're leaving something on the table. You got to get this big guy with all the connections, or everybody else is going to leapfrog us, and we're going to be stuck. That kind of fear is another reason. You know, you feel like you have to have these higher, powerful people that know stuff you don't know. That's another part of it.
100%, 100%. I know it is weird, but it's really not as scary as people think. You know, and like, sure, would we maybe have been better off if we had some big time manager the whole time in our whole career? Hard to say, you know, maybe not. But at the same time, I don't think I'd be, you know, able to have what I have, you know, in my life.
So. Well, better off than what? I mean, it's like in a way, if you just really get into looking at this exact specific niche thing, genre, part of the genre that Silverstein is, that you are the best one, the most you've achieved the most. You have, you know, over 1 million Spotify monthly listeners. You played more shows than any band, probably. Like, you probably have a bunch of records that you haven't, maybe you have counted them, but if you've been doing this for 20 years at the top of this, you know, specific, I know there's bigger bands and other stuff, but this style that you do, how could it have gone better?
Right. No, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, the only thing that could have gone better is like maybe a little more clout in, like, I don't know, winning some fucking awards, which who cares about anyway?
Right.
You know, like there's that kind of thing, you know, or a movie soundtrack at some point, or, you know, whatever. Those big opportunities that maybe having a manager would have opened up. But I don't know, you know, like if we ended up fighting victory and getting off the label and signing to something like Island Def Jam, and next thing you know, someone's telling us we got to write these kind of songs, and I'm not saying Island Def Jam, I'm just saying any major label, maybe that would have been an absolute kiss of death, you know? And the fact that we never had a hit, I think, is also maybe helpful, because once you have that hit, once you have that hit, it can be the kiss of death for sure. Like you can have like all these, you're all over the radio, you're all over MTV at the time or whatever. And it's like, you get all these fair weather fans that don't really like you. They like a song kind of, or they think they're supposed to like a song. So then they come to your show. Maybe they buy a shirt once. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, this band isn't really cool anymore for the people that actually care about it. Or the band starts catering to these people. And you end up in situations where really you just never can get that lightning in the bottle success again. And you know, the songs I'm talking about that we've had blow up in the scene. And a lot of those bands have really not been able to maintain that, and their career has really suffered. Right. In the long term.
So your sustainability and stability, like that, you've had very little member changes. I mean, you know, just Neil to Paul, Mark. I mean, that's a normal change, and everything else has been so sustainable and so stable. You've been able to achieve so much in the compound interest way. Like, do you know anybody that's played more shows than you?
Don't know. Don't count other bands' shows. We got to 2,500 recently.
So you've done, you know that for sure. You've done over 2,500 shows, right? I know that we're between 1,000 and 2,000, but you know, for instance, we have not been able to in any way keep pace with you guys. We were super derailed by having 13 children in our band. So that definitely, but we were able to stabilize that, which I'm proud of, like continue even though that, but you guys have been the most dedicated, focused on your craft, on your fans, on your touring schedule, on your business of any band. I am quite sure that's the case.
You might be right. I mean, I never think of it like that. And this is just me. This is what I do. And we haven't really taken any breaks, I guess. And we have zero children in the band. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm sure that's all helped, you know, get us to this point. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you look back at other bands over this period of time, if anyone's played more shows. Maybe not.
I mean, I'm sure bands in general have, but for sure in this realm, I mean, I would like to know who else is up there. I'm sure August Burns Red has a lot.
They've
pretty
probably
sure.
done a lot. Bayside's probably done a lot of shows.
Bayside's got a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just of bands that I'm friends with, but there could be some on the other, you know, it's a little bit outside of my world that I'm not thinking of. But yeah, I don't know. It's not a contest, you know, and we certainly don't every year on January 1st go, what's the most amount of shows we can play this year? We better play more than, no, we try to do things that make sense. And like, we're not trying to, I think, in the early days, we might have played too many shows.
Mm-hmm.
We might have took too many tours, and the tours we did might have been too long. You know, I think it was like, did we really have to play, you know, like Atlanta 4 times a year, you know, or whatever? And we, you know, I don't know. Maybe we did have to. Maybe that was important. But it is funny now because we don't play anywhere 4 times a year now. You know, that's just not happening.
But still, extremely active, you know.
We are, yeah.
Like,
we are.
How do you think about what to do from here? Because at this point, what else? Like, how do you stay on track to even have ambition or goals or vision? Or do you just, is it less that way? It's just more still day to day. And, you know, do you think long term?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And plan?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not even kidding you. Like, the 5-year plan might be a bit of a joke to some people. It's not to me and Paul.
Tell me about it.
We do have a 5-year plan. Well,
talk to me about 5 years.
I don't want to get too specific into things because sometimes some of them are so ridiculous.
Yeah,
like 2027. It's so out there. But the idea is like we'll put those things out there, almost like in maybe in a way a little bit of like a joke, but sometimes they end up happening.
Beautiful.
Which is kind of,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's kind of fun. It's a, you know, but yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I think every time we are still trying to grow in every territory. And like when we talk about somewhere like the UK, which has never been that good a market for us, like the last time we played London, we headlined the biggest show we'd ever played. We sold out Electric Ballroom in London. You know, biggest show we've ever done in London, which is pretty cool to be able to say that, you know, 20 years in. So it's like, okay, how can we expand on that? What can we do? You know, so that's just one territory. And the same thing in somewhere like Germany, where we do really, really well. It's like, we want to play the clone Palladium. How can we do that? Let's get to that level. Let's make that happen. You know, we really wanted to do Riot Fest this year. We hadn't done Riot Fest in a long time. We really wanted to play it. We're doing it. Last year, this year, we wanted to do Rock and Ring and Rock and Park in Germany as well. Like, you know, we have goals, you know, and we continue to do what it takes to achieve them. And, you know, we wanted to have a little bit of radio success on this last album. So we worked on that, and we ended up having some pretty good radio success with our song Ultraviolet. Can't see it with my own eyes. Can't feel the lows or the highs. Just stop when I try to fight it. I get lost in the ultraviolet. Cannot rewire my head when all the connections are dead. Just stop when I try to fight it. I get lost in the ultraviolet. So there are like things that we still feel we can do that we haven't done before. And you know, I think it's fun, you know, to keep working at that and be like, hey, we want to do this year. Well, guess what? We were able to do it. So what's next year, you know, and what's the year after that? And, it's not just rinse, repeat. Like maybe some people were like, oh my God, mm-hmm. 10 albums. It's like, yeah, I guess you could look at it as like, there it is called an album cycle for a reason. But at the same time, we're not trying to do the same thing over and over again. And we're trying to continue to grow. And, you know, we're going to Japan in like a month. You know, we haven't been to Japan in 7 years. So, you know, there's you know, a lot of things we're doing. We're about to play Australia with Amity Afflictions, the biggest shows we've ever played in Australia, too.
Crazy.
You know, with them. So, you know, we're still really, really working hard to just do bigger and better.
It a lot of bands, whenever, I mean, I feel this way about our band and other bands that I talk to, involved with, whatever, we tend to get in this mindset that is we have a ceiling. Like you can't do anything about our Spotify. Mm-hmm. It's like, what can you do? We're all, you know, we have what we have and that's all it can be. And I don't like that, but I'm stuck there. And you seem to not be stuck there, and it seems to make a difference. So I just, you know, I think that's notable, because it's got to be a myth that there's a ceiling, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's a ceiling.
It feels like it, though, for a lot of bands. Like, well, we get the it's like a passive. It's like I'm angry at myself for having too passive of a mindset. It's like, well, if we get the offer, if some stuff comes in, you know, but it's this like, that's not good enough.
I think like the as cheesy as like the word like manifesting something, like that whole idea has become, like, I think there's something to it. Like, I mean, if you really put your mind to something, I think you can do it. You know, it's not just like thinking of it in your head and it happens. Like, but if you got to take the steps, you know, and there are steps. Like sometimes they to play Rock and Ring in Rock and Park in Germany, the biggest rock festival in the world. We did it early in our career and we wanted to do it again. And we couldn't just say, hey, we want to play your festival. We had to go and we had to sell tickets in Germany. And then we had to play some other festivals and headline some other festivals. And then it's like, okay, we're on their radar again. They're mm-hmm. we want you on the festival. We're stoked to have you. Great. Done. You know, check the box. And I think that's like everything in being a band. You know, where are you trying to go? What are the steps? And there's no ceiling. They're really, you know, I mean, okay, maybe there's a somewhat of a ceiling.
But you hadn't reached it yet. That's for damn sure.
If you start thinking about that ceiling and being like, well, that's never going to happen. That's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there was a period in our time in our band when we were like, okay, we toured in buses. Now we're touring in a bandwagon. And mm-hmm. looking at the numbers, I don't know if we can tour in a bus again, but we did. We worked on it, and we, you know, we built things up, and you know, we generally always tour in a bus now, you know, whatever. Just things like that, you know, that you have to do. You got to do what you got to do to get where you need to get. And it's not always easy, but you have to have the right mindset. I think it's very important.
That's certainly true and clear. What was the hardest time, the most jaded, the obstacle, if you had to look back at this, you know, the genre cycles down and maybe it's all the way back up, but you know, what was the hardest time or darkest time?
Ooh, that's tough. I don't know if I have a clear answer. There definitely have been some ups and downs. I think it was a little bit weird around our fourth album, Shipwreck in the Sand touring cycle. We made a really, really strong album. It's still one of my favorites. But you're always coming off the album before. And you know, our album before was called Arrivals Departures. It was not a good album, still not a good album. And it was that was supposed to be the follow-up to Discovering the Waterfront, the album everybody loved. Uh-huh. So we got through the album cycle of the bad album just fine, you know? But it was like everyone was an album behind. And when we put out Shipwreck in the Sand, and I was like, fuck yeah, like we did an album I'm really proud of. It's like a concept album. It's got so much to talk about. The songs are great. It's heavier. You know, it's going to be great live. And then we started to see a lull. Like people were not coming to our shows as much. And people weren't talking about our band as much. And Victory, it was our last album for Victory. They weren't promoting it as much because they knew that we weren't going to re-sign to the label. We were trying to tell them we might, but you know, and we didn't have the like same marketing. And this was also like when digital music started becoming a thing on iTunes, but we weren't on iTunes because Victory, if you remember this, refused mm-hmm. to put music on iTunes at first. They were like the only label. I think Tony wrote like a letter, like an open letter to Steve Jobs or something.
Oh,
like,
that's hilarious. Like, yeah, I would love about, to find like, that. Oh. See if you can find that letter. Oh my gosh, I'd love to read that.
Because in a way, like I saw his point. He's like, what do you mean you're taking 30% of like Apple's taking 30%? And they still do.
Right.
You know,
right.
It is kind of insane, right? And the whole selling songs for 99 cents instead of selling albums for $13.99, like that, all that. I understood where he's coming from, and he was the only one that really pushed back on it, but all that was hurting us. And I think, yeah, for like a couple years there, in transitioning to like a new label and figuring out what we were going to do next, it was kind of a bit of a tricky time. And I don't really know. I guess we just, you know, like I said, we just manifested building it back, and we tried to do the right things at the right times, and we tried to write the best songs we could, and we slowly kind of worked our way back. But you know, I don't know. There's obviously like there are things that go up and down in waves. Right now we're at a pretty high point. You know, we're playing like the biggest rooms ever we've ever played, and it feels great, but will it last forever? Will things cycle down a little bit? Probably at some point. That's, you know, we can't do anything about it. We just ride the wave and try to make the best decisions we can, you know, at whatever time.
Is the role of friendship important in that? Like the, you know, there's something underneath even performing, just, you know, seeing you guys out and Billy and Josh telling me about how they're playing golf every other day on tour, or, you know, they said you did a whole tour, you play golf every day before soundcheck. Yeah. It's like, is that important? I mean, that's a dumb question, but
I think so. Yeah. I mean, we've always been like, I know, I mean, Paul, Mark and Billy are very close. Like they live near each other in Toronto and they see each other all the time, you know, and we're all like close. We're all friends and respect each other and always have, both as friends and musicians. But also though, like you see some bands that like get home from tour and then like the night after they're like all hanging out at the same bar and they have all the same group of friends and everything. I think that's weird. You know, like you go to a party and it's like everybody's there and everyone has the same friend group, and then there's like friend drama that's like mm-hmm. getting its way into like the band. You know, and I don't know if Emery has anything like that. I know a lot of you guys grew up together and went to college together and stuff, but I think that that's weird. So I think you need to have some separation between, you know, being like friends and being really into each other's personal lives and also being a band. I think that, I don't think you have to, it has to be. I think that that's the best way. And I think we have a really great balance of that, where of course, we're on tour, we're hanging out every day, and we're going to do things, and we're playing golf, and we're going to restaurants and whatever, we're going to ball games or whatever, you know, whatever we want to do. But at the same time, like, we go home to our own houses, and then, you know, we'll see each other here and there, but it doesn't necessarily mean like, okay, you're my best friend, we hang out every day, whether we're, you know, whether we're on tour or not or whatever.
Yeah, that gives me an insight then, in that the core of Emory is way centered on the friendship, and then there's the music, and then there's the business, basically. And it's probably a difference in Silverstein and Emory that probably has a lot to do with the level of business success. It would be that we are certainly in the not overdoing it, because, again, it's just is like the friendships are primary. Like, that's my family, or it's not family. But it's in a way, it's more than family for us. It's just is. But it's probably, well, it's certainly over codependent and has effects that isn't as professional. Yeah, I'm certain that there's some limitation in that, now that I hear you say it. But there's a professionalism also, and we're lower on the professionalism part, I would say.
I mean, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. But I mean, again, you can't paint everything with the same brush. Like, you guys, I've known you guys very long time, and I know your personality, and Toby, you know, and Devin. I know how you guys are. And I know how, and you guys are all very similar too, by the way. I know you probably don't think you are, but you are. And I think that it really does, like, kind of just work, you know, what you're doing, how you guys all look at things. You look at things the same way. And for the most part, everybody's pretty chill. Mm-hmm. Generally. Like, you don't,
we
have
are involved
asshole.
In each other's lives. You don't and have stuff, that big though, very deeply.
You don't have that big ego, though, guy that needs this, and that. You don't have that in your band. You don't have to, like, really manage anything like that. So I think for you guys, it works, and it works well, and you guys have all the other stuff you do, too. That's a part of your business that's not part of your band, like all the podcast stuff, you know, which is sort of the band, but not really, right?
And yeah, but again, those are both outgrowths of just, well, we got to do stuff together. What are we going to do? I don't know, music. I don't know, podcasts. I don't know. <That's> it's cool. More like that. Those are things on top of what we actually are, is the way I would say it. So there's definitely downsides to that. But hearing it in contrast to you is gives me some insight. So that I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, there's like no one way to do anything. That's the, if you want to take anything away, this conversation is no one way to do it. You can do things so many different ways, and find that right way for you to do something.
Yeah.
That's key.
Right. Yes. So when you talk about that time and leaving Victory, it seems like you may have had less conflict with Victory than most people. And most people won't even touch the topic, to be honest. It's like, I wish more people would talk about that label and that guy, but you seem to have had less. Well, tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where to start. It was fucked up, and it was crazy. It was like a full-on, like, abusive relationship. It was whack, and we didn't necessarily know. I mean, we knew it wasn't right. We knew things were wrong. We didn't necessarily know how it was supposed to be, because we never were with a label that, like, we could just call and be like, hey, we're thinking about this. And they go, yeah, cool. This is the budget. Go do it, or whatever, or we'll help you do it. This was like, everything's a fight. Like, it was insane. But, you know, leaving Victory it felt so good. But then there were, like, things about it. We were like, okay, well, Victory was, like, pretty good at, like, selling records and marketing. Mm-hmm. And they had some good ideas, and they had a huge staff of people. And, you know, I don't know, man. It was a crazy time. It was a crazy, crazy time.
So he had a system that was just leveraged up to an insane degree, where he was able to actually act abusive in technical, real terms, and provide a value that would make people tolerate the abuse?
Yes. And not just
crazy.
The bands.
Crazy.
Not just the bands, like record producers and video directors and other companies, like distributors, like even companies like bigger than Victory would put up with him. It was crazy. I just don't know how he was able to operate that way for so long. But it was almost like a Trump thing where like your expectations are so low of what he is going to do or say that when it was like, okay, like, oh, well, all right. I mean, he was totally like, still an asshole and still said some, right. said some shit he shouldn't say, but it wasn't that bad. So, hey, okay, well, you know, give him a pass.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a similar archetype for sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was owning that low bar of everybody knows he's shitty, but hey, he's getting results, or hey, he's disruptive. So let's, if you've already got in your mind that he's going to be shitty, then somehow you could tolerate it more or something.
I know, right?
But
exactly.
This bully and all that stuff. And it worked until it didn't. But how did it, what's the story? How did it work for so long? And what is your understanding of when it stopped working?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, he had a lot of trouble signing bands, I think, at some point. I think the jig was up, and you know, most of the bands that were you know, bands everybody knew about or wanted on the label on their label, you know, they were just signing to other labels. They were signing to labels like Pure Noise or I don't know, whatever other, or, you know, Rise Records, like Hopeless Records, just other great labels that were doing things. And I think also Tony probably didn't want to pay out the bands, you know, as much too, because he was pretty cheap with that stuff. You know, he had a lot of success signing bands at a point that nobody else really wanted, our band included. Nobody else really wanted to sign us. No one was lining up. We had a couple other offers, but they were smaller labels. I remember A Day to Remember, they said they were going to break up if they didn't get signed. And Victory was the only label that wanted to sign them, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think Tony did a really good job of that for a while. And then I think that just stopped working. Maybe they just couldn't find the bands. Bands were not sending in demos the same way they used to be. I don't know. But we're talking about this guy. He's out of the picture, but like, he sold his label and he made a lot of money and he's fine. You know,
what does he do now? You have any idea?
No idea. After he sold the label, the catalog and everything, cause now it's run by Concord. It's since he sold it, he started another label. I think it was called like Mission 2 or something. And he had a couple hardcore bands, but that didn't pan out. And then he ended up selling all the stuff from the office. I don't know what the office is now, but the Victory office is gone. I remember it was funny that they were doing like an auction of like some of the like office equipment and stuff they had. And I think Hawthorne Heights might have bought some of the screen printing stuff they had. It was like auction. I think JT was going to buy it. I don't know if he ever ended up buying it. It would have been very funny. But like one of the only bands that sued the label, buying stuff liquidated. But no, man, I don't know. I don't know what he's doing now. I got no ill will to like it's what happened. And I hope he's doing whatever he wants, you know, having a good, you know, retirement or whatever he's doing. I don't know. But I don't know, man, he still made out like a bandit. You know, he sold that catalog and I don't know the exact number he got, but it was a lot.
Big, good catalog. And nobody, yeah. I mean, he definitely was able to achieve a lot. When we signed A Tooth and Nail, because we made our album, we made The Week's End and then sent it to a bunch of labels, and we couldn't get anybody to pay attention at all until we made it. And then obviously people would pay attention. So a bunch of labels were interested once we had it. And we went through a process and chose Tooth and Nail and signed A Tooth and Nail and everything. And then just about 2 months later, after we were on that train and doing that, we got this letter from Tony. It was like, oh, this is awesome. I want to sign you guys. So I was like, sorry. But there's an alternate universe where we'd have been in the Victory world or whatever. So I just
think about that.
I don't know.
Would it have been bigger? I mean, Tooth and Nail still was a big label with good marketing.
My guess would be that we would have been bigger and had more problems and crashed and burned. That's I do not think we'd have had what we have. I do think it would have got out of control. If we got bigger, I don't know if we would have handled it well, to be honest. Like, I think we self-limit in some way. I mean, I think I feel that we self-limit in some ways because it's like I don't know if it's even better to be bigger, but you always think it would be, but I've seen it go wrong for so many people. And then to be in that environment, I know we would have fought unreal. I don't think we could have been as diplomatic as you seem to. Like, you navigated even that victory thing so well to the way you're describing it, and then you played it well. You got through it. You didn't turn it into some crazy thing. You know, I don't know that we would have navigated any of that very well.
No, we had a great relationship with Tony. I mean, in terms of, I mean, compared to other people.
Compared to other people, absolutely. You must have.
Tony liked us, and he used to tell us we were his favorite.
I believe it.
He always felt like maybe he told everybody that. I don't know. But, you know, we always felt like he did treat us maybe a little bit better than the other bands. And I think most of that was just that him and Paul had a good relationship. Well, you know, good. And Paul kind of knew how to push his buttons, I think.
Oh man, it was some of the stories. It's just crazy. But you know, back to, you know, talking about Tooth and Nail, I guess that's what you do around here.
You know, there were some bands on Tooth and Nail that I thought were so good that never popped off. Like, I think the number one band I think of is Dead Poetic. Mm-hmm. That band was awesome. And like, yeah, like the New Medicines, what a record. And, you know, if that came out on Victory, would it have been different? Yeah. Or was destined? They might have just been destined to crash and burn. I don't know.
Yeah, I think they were destined to.
I listened to it the other day.
I don't think they were going to have a... I mean, it could have gone different, but Brandon, the singer of that band, had, you know, what he does now in graphic design. I think that was always going to be what he was going to succeed most at. But even just Dead Poetic, what they were able to achieve was pretty good. But yeah, so I don't know if they could have had an alternate path really or not, but you know, you never know. But yeah, they're definitely one of those. What other Tooth and Nail bands stuck out to you?
Well, before we get into the other ones, I remember we rolled up Dead Poetic. We played a bunch of shows with them. And they looked the part, man. They were the band. They dressed well. Their hair was all good. They were all in like good shape. They had like, you know, you got a typical trailer, van and trailer, and most trailers have like a side door. And they had turned their side door into like a closet where they would hang up all their clothes, and they had their shoes and everything for their. And I was like, whoa, these guys are like professional
wardrobe,
you know, and like they care about what they're wearing on stage. And I honestly wondered later on when I thought back to that, if maybe that hurt them a little bit, if maybe they like looked a little too good, like if it's seen, if at the time, like nowadays you would, that's the goal, I guess, right? Everybody wants to like look like Ollie Sykes or whatever, but like, you know, back then it was like you didn't, putting on like a wardrobe or whatever was like kind of lame, you know? And I don't know if that like hurt the band, but I mean, it's just certainly like the record was amazing. And yeah, I mean, geez, Brandon, what a singer too.
His
imagine being that good at singing. You're like, yeah, I don't want to sing.
I don't think he enjoyed it that much. I really don't think he was enjoying the performances. And I think there was something that he wasn't totally ever locked in some way that, I mean, I'm not one to put any words in his mouth, but his presence on stage, it was a good image, and he was absolutely dominant. It's like, oh, there's a front man. Like, there's a bunch of bands playing, and this guy's a front man right now. Like, he definitely had it there, but I think he had some tension with the role and the everything, you know, fundamentally somehow.
Yeah, I think so too.
And singing or whatever it was. But yeah, that's a good, I agree. Especially when you look in the Emery, Silverstein, Dead Poetic, those, I'm sure we show up in each other's Spotify a lot.
Probably.
Sounds like or recommended to or whatever.
You know, a lot of people thought early on that we were a Christian band because our first booking agent, after we signed to Victory, we couldn't get a booking agent from a real company right away. Nobody wanted to touch us. Mm-hmm. And we had this guy, Michael Kelly from Houston that booked us, and he just booked Christian bands. So our first tour was with Narcissus. You remember Narcissus?
Oh, wow. Yeah, totally.
Our first ever US tour. Yeah. Was with Narcissus and
Cornerstone band.
And I can't remember the other there was another Tooth and Nail band on some of the shows, and House of Heroes. I don't think they were ever on Tooth and Nail, but
no, but I yeah, love that, it. You're right about the scene association with them. Yeah,
yeah. So we were on tour with these Christian bands, and everybody thought we were Christian, and we were playing. I think we played Gathering Grounds, you know, in Dayton, and we were doing, you know, so it was like funny. I was getting all these emails and stuff from people being like, "Oh yeah, you're, you know, your lyrics." This song about Jesus. I'm like, I hate to break it to you. This is not about Jesus. This is about like f-ing my girlfriend in a park, dude. But, you know, but yeah, it was funny, man. For a while, we had that association because we just kept getting shows and tours with those bands because that's just what he booked. You know, yeah. Narcissist guys were fun. That first tour was so stupid. We were riding around the American South. We played like Fort Smith, Arkansas, and we played wow. Places like that. And we all thought it was a good idea to buy these cap guns. and we would shoot cap guns at each other. Oh my God, how stupid were we? But yeah, there's an end of tour photo where we're all holding these like cap guns in the photo. Mm-hmm. And of course, you got to take the like orange thing out of the front, right? So it looks like a real gun. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that and firework battles. You ever have any of those?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the kind of stuff you do days, in your man. Early 20s. You shoot fireworks yep. in the van at each other and other vans going down the road and then parking lots and stuff like that.
Bill was like 19 at the time, 18 at the time. Oh, my God. Yeah, we were just – and those Narcissist guys were a bit older, too. I mean, not that old, but I think John was like – I think he was like in his late 20s, which was like, oh, my God, he's so old. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that was like our first ever tour. So, and they were nice, and I don't know, it was cool. It was cool to see some of those bands and some of those scenes and everything. But yeah. I don't know.
And over time, the bands that have lasted this long, they have some qualities that are. It's just really cool to see because it feels like the value. Like when I'm at Is for Lovers Festival, I'm like, okay, these are just the people that actually care, actually are good, actually put into work, actually are fun. Why else would we be here still? Or something. And there's nothing stupid about it. I just have really, really gotten a lot out of being at Is for Lovers and think it's great what JT has done. And,
yeah.
You know, that whole thing feels like, to me, it kind of feels like the end of, I mean, okay. Two ways, but I don't want to act like we're old because JT actually gets mad when Toby says from stage how old we are. JT always gets mad about that and tells him don't do it.
But, really?
Yeah, because he don't want to project being old because it's not really that, but we just kind of can't help but make fun of it. But the bands now sound better than ever. They're high energy. They're freaking ripping it on stage. It doesn't seem like old people playing. It sounds like, man, these bands are nailing it. The bands that are out there, or they're on the cruise, the Emo's yeah. Not Dead Cruise and the Is yeah. for Lovers. It's like bands killing it that are seasoned and good and still really bringing it. That's definitely my experience. On the other hand, something about it reminds me of the end of the movie A League of Their Own, which is one of my favorite movies. It's like the Women's Baseball Hall of Fame. They go, they like you see the people that you saw long times ago, and now you're hanging out again in this cultivated environment. I just love that feeling. It's like just seeing the people. It's like, oh, I just analogy. Saw. It's just like, oh, Nate from Amberlin again. Like I see him every week, or like, oh, I just see him. I see you, or just, oh, yeah, just like you're down the street. It feels like the whole country's small, and everything's down the street. And it's like where you have all the reflection of the past, and it's just so easy. And it's like, oh, the good people are here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love it. I think like. Being a band like Silverstein and probably Emery too, we're bands that don't really fit anywhere and never have. We're too heavy to play like with the pop punk bands, and we're way too soft to play with the real metal bands. So there's never been that like real pocket until now. Like Is for Lovers. We made it.
Like we created itself by just like what I'm saying. It's like a league of our own. It's like our own thing. Like we don't fit anywhere. That's always been. It was, oh, we're too Christian. We're not this, or we're not well, we just are. And then it's its own thing.
Yeah,
it took a long time to build.
It's a beautiful thing. It did, and but I mean, obviously, it's been doing very well, and you know, there's a reason people have wanted this. So no, it kicks ass. I'm stoked. Yeah, we're doing another one next weekend.
Ohio,
actually, Tennessee? Massachusetts.
Oh, Massachusetts. Yeah, we'll be there. We're doing Ohio and Tennessee, and then I'll see you in Massachusetts in a couple weeks. I'm leaving tomorrow for that trip.
It's gonna be good.
I'll, when this comes out, I'll be between those two, and I'll be seeing you in a few days from when this drops. So,
love it. Cool.
Yeah, cool. And then maybe it cycles back down, or maybe – okay, so here's where I'm at right now on analysis. Either it cycles back down from here, but we're in some kind of peak, which is nice, or trending up indefinitely. Is that possible?
I think it's super possible. You know, I think like the demand is there. I think people want this. And I think the rollout's been smart, starting out doing like a few and growing and like, you know, why can't it be?
But I mean the whole scene, the everything, your shows, your headline, everything. Do you think it's possible? Because at this point, we thought emo and this stuff might die or just be a blip in something. But now it's like, oh, this is like one of those channels on XM radio for eternity or something. It's like 60s, 70s pop, 70s alt rock, whatever it is, emo, heart, you know, whatever this genre is like permanent somehow now.
I think it could be.
And it like catches new generations. So what do you think? Are you looking at younger generations? Are you paying attention to new stuff? Is it going to attach to the thing we're doing? Can the whole thing grow from here?
I think so. I mean, I think there are constantly younger artists that are mentioning our bands, you know, they're saying, oh, like, I got this Victory Record sampler, or I went to Warped Tour or whatever. Right. And now I'm making this music. And sometimes it's funny because I'm like, I don't hear it. Like, I don't hear my band in your music. Like, thank you for citing me as an influence. I don't hear it. But I do think that, like, in the same way that, like, one of my favorite bands, well, let's talk about one of my favorite bands on Tooth and Nail. Like, I love Craig's Brother. Great band. I love Slick Shoes. Love them. Like, absolutely love them. Those bands don't sound like Silverstein, but I would consider them an influence of mine, you know? So whatever it is, like, whatever is happening with this, there's something that's latching on, that's continuing to make our bands and our scene transcend generations.
Right.
And that didn't happen with like hair metal. Hair metal died and is dead.
Right.
And there might be a couple bands that can still do it. Or there could be, like, you know, I'm in Vegas. There's probably a hair metal band playing at a casino off the strip somewhere, you know, it's still there. But I think the relevance in terms of the mainstream is could be really, really huge. And you're seeing some of the artists, you know, when you looked at like Juice WRLD, you know, or Lil Peep, or some of these artists
that really, cool, yeah,
really made like some important music that's going to stand the test of time and where they were influenced. And like, there's going to be more artists like that, because you just look at the age of them. They're going to find out about these bands that grew up with them, and here it comes. So I think it's going to continue to grow. And I think it's real music too. Like, that's the other thing. It's real emotions. It's like, it's stuff that people can relate to, you know, in a way that's more special than talking about getting pussy on the Sunset Strip, you know,
right,
like
right,
hair metal bands did, or talking about whatever punk, like, I love punk rock, but like skate punk in general didn't have a lot of emotional, like, timeless themes, generally speaking. Like, a lot
mm-hmm,
of it,
mm-hmm. Well, it had anger,
talking about that anger was, or just kind of like a more of a destructive kind of attitude about it. Whereas our bands had talked about real emotions that are timeless. So I think that also, you know, is part of it.
Fascinating. And do you believe in the young people, or you think, oh, the young people don't get it?
I'm a believer. I'm a believer. No.
Nice.
I think they're great. I mean, I think it's so crazy right now how the technology is, like, your phone is like just has way more capabilities of doing music and showing your creativity and in recording or whatever than like anything we had when we were making, like, coming up trying to make music. It's like, and people are figuring that out. And now it's like, it's not just about technology. Now it's like, it's about what people are saying. It's about like great melodies that these younger people are writing. I don't know how this, I hear some of these songs and I'm like, that's a great melody. And it's like, that's an even better melody. It's like, how are these people so good at writing melodies now? It's really awesome. Like, I think there's some really, really great young musicians and producers coming out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great too, because now the access to get your music at a decent level where it's where you can like show it to people and not have it sound like shit like us. It's like, oh, well, I recorded this on a cassette 4-track. Like, nobody can hear a good song through a recording like that. But these days it's like, you're going to see the kind of cream rise to the top because everybody's got like that. They don't have those hurdles of bad technology anymore.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. And that's, you know, I'm excited about that. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you name any new artists? Is there anybody that's good? If we were going to try to name
anybody, you know, that's good,
right? Is there what's out there? Is anything you listen to? I'll delete this if you can't name it. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No. I mean, I'm wearing a holding absence shirt. I mean, this is that's a band right there. I can just talk about and how good this band is, and they just put out their, I guess it's their third album now, but it's like the kind of their second. It's kind of like their sophomore record because they blew up on the last one. And I mean, this band is amazing. And what I like so much about Holding Absence is they have these banger, like, you know, 2.5-3 minute songs, which are great. But they also do the like emo epic stuff too, like epic, where they'll have like a 7 minute song. And I miss that because bands don't really do that anymore. And you look at playlists. Like another playlist, or I find out about a lot of bands. It's called All New Punk, and I'll like they'll do a lot of like unsigned stuff on here. So I'm always listening to this podcast and finding out about new bands or newer bands. And like, you know, all the songs are so short, but I love when bands like take a chance and are like, hey, this song's 8 minutes. I'm like, you write a good 8 minute song. That's pretty special.
Yeah, a lot of work.
But who else? Spanish Love Songs. That's a band I really like too. A newer band. But yeah, man, I don't know. You do put me on the spot. I don't mind. Like, I mean, I listen to playlists and I find out about new stuff all the time. And, you know, I've even done some shows on Twitch, on my Twitch, where I'll do like a locals only night. I've done a few times where I'll have bands submit their stuff, their music, and I'll have them come on my Twitch channel and just talk about it, and I'll play a tune for everybody and be like, yeah, you know, what are you guys all about? Mm-hmm. So I'm all, you know, I love
That's
it.
Awesome.
I love to try to promote, you know, the younger bands.
Well, you have a youthful attitude, a pioneer attitude, an explorer attitude. And you've Lead Singer Syndrome is a great podcast. I mean, it's more than a great podcast. Also top podcast of out there, like very relevant. Very good, and I've really enjoyed exploring podcasts with you and just being connected in these different realms of things as they unfold, and I think that's likely to continue if you're on Twitch, whatever. So, well, I don't know what is next, but we'll keep each other in tune with what the emerging things are as the pattern. Well,
absolutely. Well, I got to turn my green screen into something better, I think, and get my equipment set up and get back on the Twitch train because I do enjoy it. But yeah, my podcast's still rolling. I had an episode come out yesterday with the singer from this band Voyager. They're from Australia and they were a top 10 finisher on Eurovision. And they also happen to be a progressive metal band. So that's a really interesting story.
Wow.
But you know, I had Mike from MXPX 2 weeks ago too. So, you know, I try to still turn out a lot of different stories and stuff on Lead Singer Syndrome, which I've been doing now for 8 years.
Amazing. Oh, can you believe that we'll have 10 years of podcasting? But we're basically like, I think I'm pretty close to 10. I think I might be at 10 years of podcasting. Yeah.
Well, Matt, I could not have done Lead Singer Syndrome without you. Literally, people that don't know, it was Matt that got it off the ground. So thank you for that all those years ago.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. But yeah, I enjoy doing all these things. And, you know, I've just enjoyed catching up today. So thank you for it.
Absolutely. I know it's almost 2 hours we talked. I feel like we could talk for another 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, your podcast and what you do, it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff in it's a lot there. And that's, I think that'll last a long time. It's a lot of your stuff's evergreen. People can go to it. They can find the value. You know, this talk format is really good for history. And I don't know, I feel that it's useful to do beyond just the stats or the money or the career part. It feels good to do. And I'm glad you're in the game. You're great at it.
I'm all about it. But yeah, Matt, well, thanks for having me here. And I feel like I didn't talk enough about Tooth and Nail Records. Are people gonna
It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. I appreciate that you mentioned it, but you had to do that even anyway. But I it's obviously authentic, but thank you.
I wanted to talk about one of my favorite punk bands, Christian punk bands called Broken Cedars, but they weren't even on Tooth and Nail, so never mind.
That's okay. This is the place for all the overlap between what you do and the non-Tooth and Nail, and all that works here.
Wants to hear a skate punk band from the 90s that were great and Christian, check out Broken Cedars. That's all. That's all I have to say about that.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Matt. All the best.
Appreciate it.